All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. Today, I'm talking to Kathleen Hanna. I was nervous, man. I was nervous. She's the lead singer of the band Bikini Kill and a pioneer of the Riot Girl feminist punk movement. And look, I always knew who she was, but for some reason, there's a huge chunk of my life in relation to music and art that I sort of missed because I was doing comedy every night. There's TV shows, there's music, there's live music, there's all this stuff, you know, starting from like 89, you know, through the mid 90s, really, even more, where I was just in comedy clubs every night. That was my whole fucking life. You know, I'd listen to CDs or whatever. But I always knew about Kathleen. I always knew about Bikini Kill, but I don't know that I'd ever really processed it or taken it in or listened to it. And I always found her a bit intimidating just as a being. I decided that she was intimidating. The weird thing is like I read her book. I read the whole book, Rebel Girl, and it's a great book. It's a because not unlike any good, like even like Moon Zappa's memoir, is that it's of a time. You know, Moon Zappa is of a time, but it's also about the Zappa family. Rebel Girl is of a time, you know, in the 80s and in the 90s, you know, in terms of where she started out, you know, in Olympia and then, you know, moving, you know, to the East Coast and just the punk rock life and how it connected to the art of the time and also the feminism of the time. There was just this point of connection that sometimes I forget about in terms of the way I grew up and what I was thinking about and reading about. Yeah, about art and about impact and about, you know, ideological passion, which, you know, I'm not a woman and I was not a feminist activist, but the intellectual sort of foundation of feminism in the 80s, it's just an odd kind of coincidence, I guess, for me in that way. Like, look, when I went to high school, I was pretty dead set on the idea that I was going to be an artist, and I was pretty sure it was going to be photography. And I was kind of consumed with art, and I worked in a bagel shop, a bagel restaurant by the university. I was constantly talking to artists. I was going to art shows. I was involved with sort of going to see performance art. I was not like the regular kind of townie high school kid. You know, that was half of me, and the other half was sort of engaged with this art scene that was happening in Albuquerque, New Mexico during that time, the late 70s. And I was doing work, I thought very important work in the darkroom at Highland High School, which had just been rebuilt. It was like one of the greatest facilities ever, you know, built, certainly in a high school. Jeanette Williams, who was the teacher and photography teacher over at Highland, who was also a great photographer in her own right, had really gotten together. I assume she pulled the money together to make this sort of, you know, high-level darkroom, like with real fucking, you know, like high level. I was in it. And I was also in a graphics class, you know, just to learn offset printing and stuff. So I had access to an offset camera. And I would make collages and make giant negatives on the offset camera and then print them in the darkroom for some groovy kind of, you know, punk rocky looking stuff. You know, I was looking at the art of some of the bigger photographers at the time. Some of them, I remember Cindy Sherman. I remember, you know, Joel Peter Witkin, of course, but I was sort of immersed in this idea when I was in my teens that I was going to be an artist. And then when I got to college, it was sort of like, oh, man, there's so much math and photography and apertures and, you know, different papers, different films, different chemical washes. It was just too much. It was too much. So then I think I decided I was going to be a poet. And there was a lot of things going on. A lot of things going on. But I was always engaged with the art world to some degree because my mother was a painter. You know, she was going to do her master's at the University of New Mexico when I was in college. She would always, when I was growing up, we'd fly back to New York to see the retrospectives at the Museum of Modern Art. It was important. It was important. There was this idea that art could change things. And that art was important. And that you could make statements with art. And then I thought that on some level, comedy would sort of accommodate that I would be able to do that. you know, with comedy. But there's some of the foundations of some of the stuff that Kathleen was, you know, living in. I mean, she was doing photography. She was doing some performance. She was writing, you know, lyrics that later became songs. But she was like going to be a photographer. And then, you know, once, you know, she decided on becoming a feminist, I guess you would call activist, but primarily an ideological feminist punk rock singer with the agenda of elevating women and feminism. And there were just some of the things, it was just this weird coincidence that when you read a book that somebody writes about themselves, you know, you get to know them. And there was just this point of connection when I was reading her stuff, because I'm a little older than her, but not that much. And I was in New York in like 89. And, you know, she was, I guess, probably back in Washington. But there are just these points of connection. For some reason in 89, when I was in New York and I was living on the Lower East Side, I just got very involved with, like, it wasn't zine culture, but there was stuff around. The Village Voice was still around. There was this magazine called World War III Illustrated, which was sort of a, you know, a kind of revolutionary publication in a way. It was on print paper, and it was, I don't remember if it was monthly or what, but there were certain graphic pieces in there and certain essays in there that just changed the way I thought. And for some reason in the late 80s, I was going to St. Mark's Bookstore, and then I was kind of trying just to fill my brain up with, you know, I had Adam Parfrey's edited edition of the first version of Apocalypse Culture. You know, I was looking at underground comics. I was doing all this stuff to kind of feed my brain. And at some point, I got hip to Research Laboratories out of San Francisco and their books. And they put together a book called Angry Women. And it was just these profiles of these women artists, Kathy Acker, Susie Bright, Wanda Coleman, Karen Finley was in there, Lydia Lunch was in there, Annie Sprinkle, Avital Ronell, these thinkers and artists and performers that I didn't know anything about. And for some reason, I got immersed in a lot of these women who were doing this radical art because it seemed so much more fucking interesting because it had a point of view that was focused, specifically feminism, but also just sort of like mind-blowing art and just women's voices in general in art. It wasn't on my radar as much until I started to really kind of look at it. Cindy Sherman was important, Jenny Holzer. Like, I remember after I got the Angry Women book, I got Kathy Acker's book, Blood and Guts in High School, and it was like mind-blowing. I was like, what is this fucking thing? What is this voice? What are these pictures? What is this? And like, I'm wary to say I was like some sort of like, you know, I wanted to be a feminist man at that time. I was just so fucking blown away by the art of women in general. I mean, two of my, you know, fairly serious girlfriends were artists. Three. Before. I mean, when I was in college, when I met Lauren, she was a welder. She had a big black mohawk, had that sculpture in her house that she had welded, this emaciated metal female figure with just like nails in the vagina. The first time I went to her house, I saw that. And then, you know, she changed my life, changed the way I thought. But I've always been sort of like engaged or in awe of, you know, angry, creative women of any kind because they have a point of view that is not mine. It's specific, it's focused, and it's fucking raw. And it was happening in the 80s, and there was just this point of connection. And I don't know, you know, by the time I finished a book, you know, I was nervous, but I felt like I knew her a little bit, and there was a little baggage there that was, I don't know if it was real baggage in the sense of, you know, I had thought that, you know, she didn't like me, and, you know, she's married to Adam Horowitz, you know, Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys, and him. I had a little issue with him when he talked to me. I felt like he was just sort of like, you know, like, you know, who is this guy? What difference? I mean, he wanted me to wrap up the interview. I just decided that they were too cool for me and I was some sort of fucking dork. Some guy who didn't matter. But I guess that's my problem, isn't it? Hey, folks, if you're in LA next week, Thursday, October 3rd, I'll be at Largo. All my tour dates that we rescheduled and all the new ones are for next year. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour. You can see all of them. So, okay. Anyway, heading into this talk with Kathleen Hanna. The thing was, is like, I always knew who Bikini Kill was, but I don't know if I really sat down and listened. And over the last few months in reading the book, you know, I listened to all that was available. And it was just like, I don't know if it brought me back or brought me to a presence, but I was like, holy fuck, this woman is one of the most important rock people ever. Like, it was so raw and so good and so fucking earnest and fucking hard and just punk as fuck. And I'm listening to, I'm 60, and I'm like, yeah. I guess I had the experience that most people who love her and her work had when they were in their 20s, however long ago. But I missed so much because of my commitment to my particular art. And I often say, and I believe it's true, even though I was born with FOMO, born with it, that there is no late to the party, and that some things stand the test of time, and some things represent another time, and some things, you know, in their brilliance, you can sort of see how they impacted things after them. And I think that Kathleen's work is that. And I don't know. I was a little intimidated. But the book, which is excellent, Rebel Girl, My Life as a Feminist Punk, is available wherever you get books. And this is me talking to Kathleen Hanna for the first time. So let's just clear the air.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Uh-huh.
No, because I know that you were talking to Kim and that you felt like, you know, something got screwed up.
That I insulted you?
Well, you know, it was like, I think I should explain it. Okay, so I interviewed Adam at some point and it was okay. You know, my experience with him, you know, on the show with him and Mike. But like at some point, you know, I get nervous and I want to know what I'm talking about.
Totally, right? Understand.
Yeah, yeah.
I do interviews all the time and have an interview hangover afterwards.
Right. And, you know, and I guess I was overly ambitious with them in terms of wanting more information. And it just kept going on because Michael talk. Right. And
no comment.
And at some point, you know, like, you know, Adam, and I know I'm talking about your dude, but, you know, like, it's all, you know, he has a certain disposition he has in public conversations, right? And at some point, he goes like this, you know, he looks at me and he does this. He goes, like, let's wrap it up.
Yeah.
And so I was, it hurt my feelings more than anything else. I wasn't mad. I was sort of like, you know, like, so then what happens is so I get invited to this thing at you guys' house.
Yes.
It was like a
benefit for Peace Sisters, which is the organization I'm the ambassador for.
Right. So in my mind, this is just me. So I'm like, oh, well, maybe we are okay. They invited me to their house.
Yeah.
And right. But I was just on a list.
Yeah, you're just on a list.
Right. So I go there.
I didn't know who you are.
Right. So I go there thinking like, well, this is cool. They know who I am. Everything's cool.
Yeah.
And then I see Adam and he's like, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, all right. So what's that about? And then I see you and you don't even acknowledge me. And I just, it was really just basically, it come down to me being like, well, maybe I'm not really cool. It was really like that.
Okay. You want to hear my side of the story?
Okay.
It's actually worse. Way worse.
Mm.
Okay. First of all, you shouldn't be insulted at all. Because right, Adam was stoned as fuck out of his mind.
That night?
Yeah. Yeah. And as you remember, John C. Reilly was there wearing a full-on like country Western outfit with like sparkles and hats and everything. And, there's a lot going on.
Right.
I love comedy and I go to see a lot of comedy. And when I moved to New York, I was like, I'm going to not be a punk anymore. I'm going to just go to comedy.
Yeah.
And then I went and it was like all these dudes doing like domestic violence jokes. Yeah. And I was like, this, I can't deal with this.
Right.
So I moved out to LA finally, you know, 15, 20 years later. And I start getting involved in like, but I go mainly to see non-binary feminists, people of color, you know, like I don't see straight white guy comedy ever. I just don't. I just don't seek it out. So I was talking to someone who was with you or next to you.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, they were like, oh, what are you doing since you just, you know, moved to Pasadena? Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, the comedy scene here is so awesome. I'm like such a comedy head.
Yeah.
And then you gave this face like, you, and I was like,
I just wanted you to know me.
Yeah. And then you kind of like, I think you kind of like walked away. And then I was like, what's up with that guy? And she goes, that's Mark Maron.
Yeah.
Am I saying your name right?
Yeah.
Okay. That's Mark Maron. He's a really famous comedian. And yeah. I was like, oh, shit. But I also was like, well, he'll understand because he's like, yeah. I just don't go see Matt. Sure. Like, I just yeah. am not that yeah. interested in most dudes. White male yeah, yeah, yeah. dude
yeah.
comedians because I've actually seen some of your stuff and really, really like it.
Okay.
Since then, but I was like, I felt like I was kind of the asshole, but it was also kind of funny because I was like, oh, for once the straight white, because like usually I'm standing next to my husband at some event and they're like, oh, yo, Ad Rock, yeah. I love you.
Yeah.
And then they're like, hey, could you go get me a drink to me? Which I actually enjoy because it's kind of nice not being the center of attention and yeah. floating into the background. But so I felt like I had insulted you. So I'm glad that you yeah. just felt uncool. And I'm sorry you felt uncool, but well, yeah. maybe I mean, that's a good feeling to have every
well,
so often.
Right. It was insulting to a degree, but it was also leveling. And I'd gone down there, you know, and I was mad, but I didn't really put it all together until I realized like, oh, they didn't know who was there. I mean, it wasn't like, I don't even know how I got there. I went with a woman who I was seeing at the time who was a painter, and she knew more people than I did.
Yeah, she was awesome.
Yeah. And and it was one of those things where it's like, oh, it's like art people, and you know, and I'm nobody. I'm just this,
I mean, there were like a lot of people from my coworker's church.
Oh, yeah?
You know, like, so it was kind of all over the place.
And what was the organization? Because I remember there were cool t-shirts and stuff yeah. and art shirts. And
it's called peacesisters.org.
Yeah.
And that's the group.
Yeah.
And the money goes to sending women in Togo, West Africa through school to get ID cards. They get health insurance,
right. yeah, yeah,
computers.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
all this stuff. And it's run by a woman who was an educator in Togo. And she has since moved to the States and become yeah, a nurse.
There was like a film there at the that night, right? Because I remember being educated on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was sort of one of those things where we were trying to like just let people know, hey, we're doing this thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I sold t-shirts. I made like $12,000 that night.
And you did the shirts.
Yeah, I still do them. It's been like, I think 6 years or something.
Yeah.
I still do that. But can I just say something aside? I watched Glow.
Yeah.
Just recently, because I'm like, I always get to everything cool, yeah, like really yeah. late. Amazing.
Oh, good.
I was like, I love the casting director and I love Mark. Like, I was like, I couldn't, there was a certain like Rockford
yeah.
thing that you
yeah,
were doing yeah, that yeah, was yeah. like, I love Rockford. Like, right. I'm a big Rockford head.
Yeah.
And I was just like, nobody else could be cast in this role. And you kept me watching it. So thank you. You were
you're
really
welcome.
Fantastic in it. I hope it was a good experience for you. I have no idea if it was or wasn't, but
of course it was.
Really enjoyed it.
It was kind of a new experience to be working around that many women every day. And it's funny because people who are around our age, you're a little younger than me, but that dude is familiar somehow.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like everyone, their dad or somebody was around that was like that guy.
Yeah.
And somehow Sam in the show, you know, had the potential for being toxic, but he really wasn't because he was self-involved and he was not neurotic. And, you know, he was really kind of selfish more than creepy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it worked out.
Yeah. I thought it was very three-dimensional
yeah.
Read on the character.
And you came up like, you know, we grew up like, I mean, when I read the book, and I don't want to lead too much stuff, because the problem when I read books is then I know too many things. You know what I mean? Like, I don't, like, it's better if I just find them and, you know, but now I know things. I did it with Kim Gordon, too, because I didn't know if she really talked much. And she doesn't, so it was good that I read her book. But you're a talker.
Yeah.
But there were moments in it, like, because I was trying to think today how to go about it. And I think that in the same way that I grew up with parents who were, you know, emotionally manipulative, negligent, you know, selfish, and yours was a little more dramatic and horrible. But there is a part of growing up in a household like that where you spend your life kind of looking for parents.
Yeah.
And that, like, what I think the book is about in a lot of ways is you're sort of evolving a sense of self from people that you meet that you aspire to. And in that whole arc is it's kind of an amazing time that you, it was fortuitous, or that where art was and where feminism was and where music was at the time and your proximity to it and the people you were meeting. I mean, they kind of gave you an opportunity to fully become yourself.
Yeah, and to find a family.
Right.
I think that's one of the things.
Or a number of them.
Because when part of the arcs that people haven't really noticed in the book is exactly that, is that, like, you know, everybody comes from a fucking dysfunctional... Are we allowed to cuss?
Yeah.
Everybody comes from a fucking dysfunctional family. And with my particular dysfunction, I just felt like, ugh, I gotta, you know, once I got out of there, I started having memories and being like, who am I? And, like, just needed to really, really pull away and start my own life. And then I was really desperate for family, which came in the form of punk rock community, feminist community, various overlapping communities. And then when those things let me down, like when punk rock let me down by being so sexist and so racist and so homophobic,
right,
and I could go on and on, you know, I felt like I was like, had been like a lamb to God and I was being slaughtered. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it was so much heavier, I think, than if I would have come from a background where I felt, you know, not super insecure and I liked myself and, you know, I had better self-esteem. I think I would have been able to leave a lot of the toxicity behind. But but in a way, there's a good thing, because I wanted it so bad that when it didn't meet my expectations, I sought out to change it. Because I was like, I'm not leaving this family. I'm going to fix it.
Yeah.
I couldn't fix my own family.
Yeah.
But can I bring feminism into punk rock? And many, many other people had already done that.
Right.
But it was like, could I bring it into my specific, you know, niche scene?
Well, they did it to a degree in just sort of, you know, plowing through and being rock people and punk people. But it seems like you educated yourself in a much deeper way around the sort of intellectual and, you know, conceptual ideas of feminism that, you know, some people just played music. But you had an agenda early on that was informed by, you know, the people you were around.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had an agenda. That's for sure.
Let me ask you, though, in writing the book and like in seeing yourself in these situations or looking for a family, I mean, when you're in it, are you really thinking that?
No.
Right, you're just sort of like, you know, fuck, I'm uncomfortable and angry.
Yeah. But I actually didn't even, you know, because of sort of the dysfunction, I grew up in an uncomfortable, angry situation, right?
Well, yeah,
so to me, that was like normal. So when I went on tour back then and a guy was like, I'm not plugging in your monitor unless you tell me if you're married or single, I would feel grossed out and mad. Kind of, but I would also just take it.
Yeah.
Because I was like kind of used to that behavior.
Yeah.
I was used to being like, you're not really even a person. Right.
Yeah.
So it was like a lot of the stuff I did sometimes speak back to it, but it happened so often that it was just sort of like cumulative. And a lot of it, the really heavy stuff, I didn't tell people for years and years and years because I was just like, it wasn't like it's my fault. It's like, I just was like, you move on to the next thing. That's
right.
How I grew up. And I shut off my intuition as a kid.
Like, suck it up.
There was the suck it up, the show must go on, kind of Liza Minnelli thing in me.
Yeah.
And then there was I turned off my intuition when I was 4. And
why?
Because to live in my house, I couldn't really be fully myself or alive.
Well, what was going on? Like, exactly.
Well, it's just like, you know, my dad would get drunk and he would be abusive. More like psychologically and emotionally, like really kind of psychotic, abusive. He was sexually super inappropriate, like said really horrible things, like asking me if I have an orgasm, had an orgasm when I was like 15 or 16. I'm in a hotel room alone with him. And I'm like, I put that part in the book. And it was like, because it was kind of just a good example of one of the times where I was like, oh my God. I was like, no, you know, I don't want to talk about this. And it's like, no, I want to talk. And it's like, clearly so he can get his jollies.
Yeah.
Which is a word you might be, remember that? Remember when we used to say, your jollies?
Yeah, sure.
Like, I feel like people don't say it anymore.
Well, you said that, you said something about the nature of, because my parents were like naked too much and like inappropriate in ways that I look back at in that, like, when you talked about, when you first started to come into understanding abuse and what an incestuous home looks like, you know, how did that define itself for you? Like, I mean, how did you look at your childhood like that? Like,
I just looked at it like I was on a continuum. Like, my dad didn't rape me.
Yeah.
But my dad did not look at us, me and my sister, in a way that was appropriate. And he asked us questions.
Like a parent.
Like a parent. And continuing into adulthood would say really intricate sexual things to us, like about what he was doing with a girlfriend or like whatever. And it was like to the point of like we kept, you know, I would go to a therapist and therapist would say, tell your dad on the next phone call. He can, you don't want to talk about it. And I was like, I've already done that. And he would just keep talking over me, say, you know, strawberries and champagne. Like, cause I mean, he's also like a sleepless in Seattle kind of loser where it's like, that's his idea of like something like really wild.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, you know, so you sort of shut down.
Is he still around?
Yeah.
You talk to him?
No. Hell no. Fuck him.
How long have you not
like
dealt
20
with
something years?
Really?
Yeah.
But your mom is, and you're close with her?
Yeah. She lives like 5 blocks away from me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And you've got a kid, right?
Yes.
So you've got her there and that works out?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, the two of them are like completely, they're obsessed with the library. They're like at the library all the time. And it's like trying to get library cards at every library. And
oh,
like,
really?
They're like kind of like, they're kind of like, baseball wives for library. Really into libraries.
But when you started to, like, it felt like to me when, that the time that you were coming up, you know, creatively that, you know, outside of the first time you sang, which you were very young, but you felt it. You felt like that was the place where you felt like you could really do it, right?
And yeah, like, I mean, I still do. Like, I was just singing along to Lana Del Rey in the car, and I was like, ooh, I don't have to go to my head voice to hit that note.
Yeah, I was
like really psyched because I'm just coming off tour, so I'm still fresh. And I was like, oh, I really want to try to do a song. Like, you know, like, I just get really excited about singing. And now that I'm older, I also am less afraid of my voice. And I'm more like, I can get enjoyment out of it. In a way that is less like outside of myself staring at it going, that's wrong. You did that wrong. You did live. I still have that voice, it's always replaced. I can replace it. I can ride the show like a wave.
Yeah. It's so fucked up when you have these kind of parents that don't provide you the space to become yourself and be supportive of it, that, you know, that voice inside that's like, you suck it's just, you have to be vigilant about it. For your whole fucking life.
Yeah, and then there's the internet that if you ever read it, which you can't. I know, you can't. But I'm just saying, if you ever do, every bad thing you've ever thought about yourself in your head, someone will have written it in a better, funnier, crazier way than you ever could.
When they're so good at the trolls at zeroing in on your vulnerabilities and it just becomes this fucking nightmare.
But I started to, I was like, what if we are living in a simulation and like the internet is just like parts of our brains talking back to ourselves?
Oh, how's that help?
It doesn't. It's just like something that I was thinking of.
I tell this to people that have similar experiences. I mean, like I had this, because when you have these insecurities, you're constantly fighting the fight to not fuck yourself.
Yeah, to get out of your own way.
Right, because that other thing is going to do it, and you're not even going to know it's doing it until after. And then you have to sort of take responsibility for it, but also if the other voice is more stronger, you're like, well, yeah, but fuck them. Yeah, so like you can't.
I had a therapist a long time ago who was talking about inner child stuff, which isn't really my bag, but I spent the whole session trying to convince her that we needed to lock my inner child in the trunk of a car.
Sure.
And then I was like, well, I'll put a brick like in the movies onto the, you know, thing so I won't be in the car. She'll just be in the car and then she'll like explode and then I'll watch her explode and then I'll feel better. And she's like, no.
You're
supposed to like hug her and talk to her.
Integrate
and I was like, fuck her. I don't like, first of all, I don't want her like driving the bus of my life anymore. So can't we just throw her off a cliff?
Right. But it's a constant conversation.
I think it kind of goes along with something I learned while writing the book, Rebel Girl, out now on.
Yeah. Available everywhere you get books.
Yeah.
And did you do the audiobook?
Yep, I did.
Oh, that's good.
Did it all myself. There's this thing that I learned while I was writing it when I was dealing with like sexual abuse type stuff and whatnot, where I was like, okay, I have held on to responsibility for some of these things.
Yeah.
Like, but it wasn't blame. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like the whole thing of like, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's like, it doesn't matter how many times I counseled other girls and women, people in general, about sexual abuse. I used to be a counselor at a sexual abuse rape crisis center. So I know a little bit about things to say when people come to me with that stuff. And so I'd done quite a bit of it in my career as a musician. And no matter how many times I said it to other people, no matter how many times I said it to myself, I still had this enormous connection to the abuse I'd suffered as if I raped myself with my own dick.
Yeah.
You know, or punched myself in the face with my own fist, even though somebody else punched me in the face. So you know, and but I realized it wasn't that I felt like I was, there was other things that made me feel like I was a deep down dirty napkin and, you know, to wipe the floor up with. It was my only way to have agency in this situation. And I had to kind of like, God, I sound so corny, but like honor and respect that.
To
like,
own it yourself, you mean?
Yeah. To be like, it wasn't like I'm blaming myself because I'm like, why'd you put yourself in that situation? Right. It was like, I can control that not happening again if I look for these red flags. And there's a certain part of that that's true. And then there's a certain part of it that, you know, the world is a messed up place and messed up things happen.
Yeah.
And you have no control over it. To me, that you have no control over it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And through the book and like reading about my own life, kind of, you know, when you go to the editing stage and you have to put your editor's hat on and it's like you're reading about a character and not yourself anymore. I was like, whoa, like just a bunch of weird stuff happened that you had no control over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, and you can't control the world. And there's a certain thing that's just like the universe doing it, this weird stuff.
Yeah.
And it really kind of helped me let go of that and be like, hey, you know what? Like staying tied to this stuff isn't actually giving you any agency.
It's
holding you back. So like time to let it go.
Right. It's a way to beat the shit out of yourself.
Yeah.
Ongoing.
Yeah. So I basically just like TMI'd to everybody in the world so that now it's their problem.
Well, it was an interesting experience to read the book because there was a couple of things that the one thing that sticks in my mind, you know, throughout the book was like, God, I hope she gets a really good apartment soon.
I felt the same way. I felt the same way. And I was like, I want to put more joy towards the beginning. And I was like, well, you just got to write what's real. You know what I mean?
It's like, just like a series of like, they need a better car. Well, that apartment doesn't sound good at all. But she's making the best of it.
I know, but I really didn't want to come off like Ziggy, you know, under the dark cloud.
No, it didn't come off that way. It was the life you signed up for.
Yeah.
There was no other way to live that life. But it just felt like it went on pretty long.
Yeah.
Like you.
Till last year. Till I wrote the book. Cash like, my advance.
Yeah. It was just sort of like, wow, is she just sleeping on fours because she thinks she deserves it? I mean.
No, we were broke.
Yeah.
That's actually been one of the things that really surprised me because I didn't even think about that. Like, that a lot of people were like, oh, I thought you were super famous and, you know, you like had a house and all this stuff. And it's like, no, I did not have any of that. Really, the only time I got access to money was when I got together with my current husband, who is fucking rich and a rock star. And
That was after you met him. There was a point where I was like, "Come on, just get her a better place. Just like, so chip in a little bit somewhere."
But he's also the kind of person who, like, you know, when I met him, was like living in a one bedroom apartment,
right?
And just is like,
They hadn't blown up yet.
No, they had, but he's like a civilian.
Yeah. He's an interesting guy, and he's got so many records, doesn't he?
Yeah, those are at his studio, which I made him buy.
Yeah, but like, let's talk about the beginning because I felt like sort of I was interested in things around the same time you were, like in terms of art, because although you sang when you were a kid. And that you knew you wanted to do that, there was this other world of art going on that was influenced by very specific women artists like Jenny Holzer
and Barbara Kruger.
Yeah, all them. And that, you know, they kind of informed a punk sensibility before it happened. And you seemed to be at the beginning of that.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, but I was living in a small town very far away from New York.
In Olympia.
And so I was like, it's the capital of Washington State.
Yeah.
But it's also, it functions as a small town. And one of the great things about it is that it's always had a functioning downtown.
Yeah.
Which most places don't have anymore.
Right.
They have malls and then they have like a desolate boarded up.
And this is like the mid 80s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I graduated from high school in 86, so I moved there when I was 17.
So it wasn't quite completely gone in a lot of places, but they were going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just, like, different from, you know, living in the suburbs where you're so far away, or living in Portland, Oregon, which actually had a really lovely downtown as well, but it didn't have the kind of, because it wasn't a small town, it didn't have the, oh, you know everybody who works at the coffee shop.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Oh, there's long-haired Dave. He does books for prisoners.
Yeah.
You know, like, he keeps asking me if I'll do a benefit. Like, there are all these, like, local characters that you see every day. I mean, and, yeah. And I mean, it can drive you bananas. Because, like, when you're in a band, the second you go out of your house, someone's like, oh, how's your band doing? And it's like, you're in a fight. Like, you know, like, no one wants to practice, and you're totally frustrated about it. And you're like, ugh.
Right.
Or if you're dating someone, people are like, how's, you know, Timmy or whoever, fucking Timmy sucks. Like, Timmy's like, you know, you don't want to talk about it. So you sort of just, like, you know, put a baseball hat on and, like, or like, I haven't had my coffee yet. Because back then we walked to get coffee.
Sure.
It was like this weird thing. Like, the idea of having a coffee maker was so wild.
Yeah.
Like, you wouldn't have a coffee maker. Like, what am I? Am I Joe DiMaggio? I don't have a coffee maker. Like, you know, you had to walk in the morning to get your coffee. And then when Bikini Kill went on tour in England for the first time, we had our label guy, Slim Moon and Tanuvial Sampson ran Kill Rock Stars.
Yeah.
And Slim came with us to England with a suitcase full of Starbucks coffee because they didn't have Starbucks in England.
Right. And that was before Starbucks was a monster.
Yeah. And Starbucks had just started, and they sold beans. Our local coffee places didn't sell beans.
Yeah.
So we had to get them from Starbucks.
But because of that type of community, when ideas or art sort of entered it from New York or from wherever, or from a book or from somebody coming in, and that was before you were in college, right?
I was in college. I started when I was 17.
In Evergreen?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, these ideas would come, and it wasn't, like, in New York, I think you get a little jaded, but when you're out in the world, it's the same with zine culture, with punk rock in general, is that there is a sense of discovery, even though it's already been discovered.
Oh, yeah.
And you just take the template or the process, and you make it your own, and you learn the language.
Yeah, and it was so exciting because, you know, we could envision a protest and then get a bunch of people together and be like, okay, we're all going to put PAs, you know, on the roofs of our building.
Yeah.
And this is what we're going to play. Or, like, I got a, you know, I was learning about, you know, what ACT UP was doing and Queer Nation. And so I got an old slide projector at a thrift store and I put it in my window. And I lived across from a building that just had a great, big, huge white space.
Yeah.
And I started projecting slides about the AIDS crisis on the wall every night.
Yeah.
And the police could do nothing about it because I wasn't graffitiing. I wasn't vandalizing.
Yeah.
And I learned it from, you know, I learned it from you, Mark. No, I learned it from a magazine, I think, called High Performance, which is a performance art magazine from New York.
Yeah.
And they had it at our library, but it was always like 3 months behind. So I would like go to the library and like wait for it. Like that, I would read about Karen Finley. I saw Karen Finley.
Sure.
I was just really into, you know, what was happening mainly in New York.
And you were doing a lot of visual arts.
Yeah, I did photography mainly just because it was like the one cool teacher I had was a photography teacher.
Right. One of those people that just makes it happen.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when I was in high school, they had an offset press and a silk screen thing. And, you know, and you have that moment where you're like, I can just do this.
Yeah. And everything else is like stupid.
And they...
You're like, I don't want to remember the Canterbury Tales. I just want to, like, be in the dark room, like, taking pictures of bands and, you know.
What was that machine that you were in love with?
Not the stop machine.
The flatbed?
It was a flatbed printer that printed on fabrics. Yeah.
That was a life changer?
That, and then a soundboard, like the soundboard that we had in the basement. It was actually right by where I worked. But, okay, so there's this guy, his name was Hollywood. He was a bank robber.
Yeah.
And there's a documentary out about him. And he lived in this treehouse in Olympia.
Yeah.
And he's a little bit older than me. And I didn't know him, though I saw some of his friends at this coffee shop that I went to. Because I just watched the documentary. I was like, oh, I recognize her. But he used to sneak into the Evergreen State College around the same time I did. But in the science lab.
Yeah.
And he was making meth.
Yeah.
And I was like, so when I saw the documentary, I was like, wait a minute, those were the same years I was sneaking in to make art. And I was like, My art, however, did not sell.
The meth went well for him.
Yeah, I think the meth went well for a while for him.
So when did you feel like who was, like, I know that you had that roommate that was assaulted, and that
Allie,
was a huge shift in, you know, the reality of thinking around, you know, what being a victim is.
Yeah, I mean, I think mostly it was like, you know, when you get in a car crash or something and you almost die and you're like, what is my life? You know, it was like she almost died and I was like, why am I doing this photography stuff? This feels really, really stupid.
Yeah.
Or like what we all went through, you know, what we've all been going through with the Trump stuff of like, you know, a lot of artists are like, why am I making art? Like, you know, I need to be out in the streets. And you can do both, or you can use your art to do protest. And I happened to go to a school that was very much like, you know, a binary of like either you make art and you're a total hedonist or you're like an environmental activist and that's it.
Yeah.
You know, like you're either carrying a sign or you're making art. So it was very hard for me to put those two together and feel like that was okay. But Allie, you know, what happened to her with the assault, that's her story.
Yeah.
That's like that affected her way more than it did me. But it encouraged me to realize something that I'd always cared about, which was ending violence against women. Like I wanted to be a part of that in one way or another, always. And in a way it was selfish because I wanted to be around other people who were surviving sexism on a daily basis and talking about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes the really extreme forms of sexism.
Abuse,
you know, I think it's,
you mean?
It's like, you know, watching, you know, people, a lot of women, and there's been a lot of conversations about it, watching shows where women are getting killed and, you know, raped and all this stuff. And, oh, I just watch it so that I can fall asleep. I don't do that anymore, but I used to. And part of it was like, I wanted to see people who survived. I kept waiting to see, well, how, I want to see a success story of like, I saw one where it was these two roommates, which reminded me a lot of me and Allie. And there was a guy like basically murdering the roommate. Another roommate walked in and she ran up into the bedroom and locked the door because she couldn't get him off her. And then she was like, I got to get out of here to get her help.
Yeah.
And she's on the second floor. And she stepped back and ran as fast as she could off the balcony and just jumped and broke her leg and then crawled to get help. And her roommate was saved. And I'm like, I need these stories.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I need these like to feel hopeful. I'm not watching them for like the, you know, trauma porn of it. I'm also watching it because sometimes it's the only place you can get community. If you're a woman who's like alone and isolated and you've had these horrible things happen to you, you're like, I'm not alone. This person had something way worse happen to them.
And
you know what I mean?
And sure.
But sometimes it would keep me from getting help because I'd be like, well, that woman died. I didn't die. Like, I'm so lucky I'm alive. I'm going to, you know, go out and do all this stuff. And as I'm doing it, I'm going to remember I'm not just doing it for me. I'm doing it for everyone who didn't make it. You know, it's like a lot of pressure to put on yourself, you know.
But initially, it drove you into, you know, learning more and becoming an actual crisis counselor, right?
Yeah.
So you took action.
Yeah.
To help. And I guess that with the music, that until, because I had, like, for some reason, Kathy Acker had a profound impact on me, too. I can't explain my period in New York in the late 80s, but there was a lot going on with, it wasn't really zine culture, but there was a lot, like, World War III Illustrated, St. Mark's Bookshop, and then somehow or another, you know, I had gotten Avital Ronell's like book and I'd gotten Kathy Acker's book and I got that research book, Angry Women. So I was like, because it seemed like the thinking was a lot more interesting than most of what else was going on. And when I read Kathy Acker's Blood and Guts in high school, I was like, what the fuck is this?
Oh yeah, me too.
I mean, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, life changing in the sense like you couldn't even wrap your brain around it.
Yeah. That's so cool. We both had the same, a very similar experience with the same book.
Yeah. And I just didn't, it wasn't like I was trying to be, you know, a feminist per se, but it was like I found the art of women at that time more interesting and had a lot more sort of not just personal relevance, but, you know, cultural relevance.
Yeah.
So I was reading, you know, all this stuff, but like Acker, I was like, I gotta know this person, but I never met her, but you did.
Yeah.
And it changed your life.
Yeah.
That was like, it seemed like that was the moment. Yeah. It was not the Andrea Jorkin moment.
No. I feel like I'm like, you know, Forrest Gump of
feminist
punk.
Well, no, it was so funny because, like, I had read Jorkin years ago, and I'm like, I had thought, like, this is a little extreme in some ways. And when you wrote that story about, you know, getting the guts up to ask her a question and how she treated you, in your book, I wrote, Andrew Jorkin's a fucking asshole. I wrote that right in there.
Here's the thing. I appreciate her extremism in the same way I appreciate Valerie Solanas' extremism.
Right, yeah.
The thing is that literally watching her give a lecture, I was like, if you want to be obsessed with porn, just be obsessed with porn.
Yeah.
You know, there was a part of me that was like, you're really obsessed with pornography. And that's also because she was a victim of pornography. But it was like, I don't want to look at all this violent porn at a feminist lecture and like just be like focused. It was really, really strange. And then she just shamed me and didn't answer my question. And this was the thing about the 90s was that if you tried to go to an anti-censorship thing, they were like, pornography's great. It's really empowering. And it's like, no, it's not. You know, how is a stapled, you know, navel in the middle of a magazine where guys are just jacking off to it, and women are jacking off to it too. I mean, I saw Shannon Tweed in Playboy when I was a kid, and it turned me on. So, I guess I'm the problem too, but whatever.
The black and white pictures?
No, Ski Bunny ones.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, oh my God, I can't believe I just outed myself. Gene Simmons, if you're listening, fuck you.
But there was also, like, you were at the juncture of that, those two sides of that early kind of punk feminism where you had, you know, that because you lived it, having done, you know, sex work, that idea that it was empowering to own it, but yet it was still judged by other feminists as being, you know, part of the male gaze and toxic culture.
Yeah, or just like you're not a real feminist if you're a sex worker of any kind. And like, I actually never found sex work empowering, to be perfectly honest. It was a job. You know, I didn't find McDonald's empowering. No. I didn't find data entry empowering, and I didn't find stripping empowering.
But did you know Annie Sprinkle?
Yeah, I knew about Annie Sprinkle, and I really appreciated the work that she was doing. And I was really excited about the idea of alternative porn. But now it's just been... The way that I think the utopian way that a lot of us were thinking about it is not what happening.
It took over culture and it became, totally exploitive. And then it just became this sort of billion-dollar content generating thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know what I liken it to kind of is like there's parts in the book where I talk about, you know, not wanting to do interviews with mainstream magazines, because anytime I would try to, it would be like they would want me to talk about, oh, so you were raped and you're a stripper and da 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 da. And it was like they would want to like sexualize the stripper stuff, and that's not what I want to talk about. My music, I want to talk about our music, you know, as a band. And I was like, it was really disheartening and traumatizing sometimes. Like, and I was just like, I can't do this, and so I stopped doing it, and then I only did fanzines, and then I had to stop doing fanzines because they started doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And it almost reminds me of the thing we're talking about with porn, where it's like mainstream porn, and then they're like, we're going to make this alternative porn, and it's going to change everything, and it's going to be more like equality-based, and it's going to be, yes, there still is some of that stuff that's happening in very small pockets that's cool that you can find.
Yeah.
But in reality, it's like how the fanzines just were emulating the mainstream, the independent porn just started emulating the mainstream. So it was just bad versions of the same mainstream, you know, bad power dynamic, toxic thing. It's like, I don't know. I think that it's an interesting thing to think about is like how capitalism infects everything and how like, can be in this scene that's like doing all these positive things, but there's still this like individualist, competitive, capitalist crap that's going on within it that needs to be faced.
It's weird because like we brought up Acker, but she told you because you were writing at that point stuff that became songs, but she literally told you if you want people to listen to this, you need to be in a band.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think she was a little bit psycho because I said nothing about music or anything, and I don't know. It was really wild. And the thing about that moment when she told me that was that it told me, it informed the rest of my life in that I realized there's a lot of people who are kind of on the margins of society who don't get told by mainstream media that you have permission to be the next Judd Apatow.
Yeah.
You have permission to be the next William Burroughs. Right. You have the permission to be the, you know, it's like you have the permission to be the next Dave Grohl.
Sure.
Maybe not now. But but like, I didn't feel like I had permission. And this person this artist who I super respected was like, you have permission.
Sure.
You not only have permission, I'm telling you to do it. And it was like, it was that small thing that like, I already probably would have ended up doing what I did.
Yeah.
But that made it happen like the next day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so when I'm interacting with other people, and I don't bullshit them and tell them, oh, I love your fanzine or I love your music, if I don't.
Yeah.
Also something I learned from Acker, because she also told me that I was kind of an idiot in terms of where my feminism was at the time. But and that really reminded me, hey, you know, the kindest thing you can do is be honest with people. The kindest thing you can do is if you listen to someone's record and you're like, you know what, you don't have a chorus here and your vocals aren't loud enough and you need slapback. Like, to just give them the notes.
Sure.
Give them the notes. Don't just say, oh, it's so great. Like, tell the truth. Like, that's being helpful. That's engaging with their work.
Yeah, it might hurt them for a second.
But it's also like being like, I listened to it and here's what I thought.
Yeah.
You know, instead of just like lying and being like, you're great.
Yeah.
All of us women are great. Let's all support each other. No, it takes criticism and challenging and also support, you know.
And also talent.
Yeah. I realized that me giving other people permission sometimes is really great.
Yeah.
And I try to do it whenever I can, like listen to what, you know, younger people are saying they want to do and being like, you should do that. I think you'd be great at it.
It seemed like the combination between what Acker said and who was it you saw, Babes in Toyland?
Yeah.
That was it. That was the 1-2 punch. And you're like, yeah, no, we did it. Jinx, you owe me a Coke. But that propelled you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so lucky. I was given like such good origin stories, right?
Yeah, but you were there like at this, like, you know, what was going on? And then so you start doing it. And then at that time, that scene in Olympia was pretty vital.
Yeah.
I mean, like there was.
I mean, it still is, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed like there was enough women around to at least have a community. No, not really.
It was still like we played to all guys with the 5 girls in the front. And, you know.
And you started telling the girls to come up front.
Yeah. And when we first started playing, it was just like, you know, a lot of people were very mad. They were like, how dare you put feminism in your music? It was really weird. It was really weird how angry people were, because I was very Pollyanna about it. Like, I was like, everyone's going to be psyched.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm, you know, putting this like, you know, feminist content into punk rock. And it's kind of become stale. It's become this like white boy hardcore nonsense where, you know, they're like, mom, make me a sandwich, you know, like, or my girlfriend won't give me a blowjob, like, or whatever their songs were. I called them, I used to be like, oh, we're having, when we had white guy hardcore at our gallery that ended up being an event space in Brooklyn shows, I'd be like, oh, comedy night?
Yeah.
Because it's like white guy hardcore, and I'd be like, oh, comedy night?
But it's so interesting to me still that like that punk seemed to at its core was really about fuck you, right? And that you know, to inform fuck you with actual ideology was so threatening to them is kind of crazy, because it just showed how shallow it ultimately was. And there was only a few bands, like, I mean, you talk about Ian MacKaye a lot, that understood intellectually the possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, when we played L.A., Flipside Magazine gave us a review that said, fuck you 11 times. That was it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, haha, but at the same time, like, they didn't give anybody else a review like that.
Yeah.
And it was like, oh, thanks for making us feel welcome. Thanks. And, like, we put on a great show. We still put on a great show. I'm not going to hold back.
Like, yeah.
I mean, I leave 110% of myself on the stage every night. And it's like, yeah, sometimes there's kind of crap shows, or I have a sore throat, or we're really tired, or like whatever, the sound is bad. But it's like, we put everything out there, like every time when we've played. And it's like, to have constantly reviews and stuff and just articles written about how all it was that we were man haters and, you know, we looked like this and I bared my breasts, which I never did. And it was like, you know, when you're 23, you're like, oh, everyone hates me. You know what I mean? And it's not like I really give a shit what Flipside said, but at the same time, you know, I'm 55 and I still remember it.
Of course.
And it's not because I think, oh, I'm a bad person. It's like, thanks for reminding me I'm on the right path. Because if I'm pissing every single, like I'm pissing off people in my own scene, I'm pissing off people in LA, San Diego, Orange County scene, I'm pissing off people in DC, I'm pissing, you know, it was kind of like, I just started, the thing that really saved me was remembering that when a kid liked me in school, they would throw spitballs at me.
Right.
And I was like, "That these people are just throwing spitballs at me because they really like me."
Yeah.
And they don't know what to do about it because it's too interesting, it's too smart, it's too good, it's too sexy. They are freaked out. So, fine. You just told me you suck and I don't have to deal with you. Thanks for telling me. I will move on. And so it allowed us to find our own community of like friends and...
But it also, like, it seemed intentional. Like, the thing, even if you do politics in general, you know, even if it's not, you know, specifically feminism, but even if you're doing political music, it seems that, you know, meatheads are going to react like, you know, what the fuck is this? Because they don't even want to do the thinking. It's not, they're not even hearing what you're saying, really, because they're not processing it other than some sort of attack on them. And it just seems to me that to have the courage to just put new ideas out there. And these ideas are still like now the world we're living in, this fucking, you know, nascent fascist reality.
Yeah.
I mean, all those ideas are being shut down still.
Yeah.
But
it seemed boring to me at the time. Like I was like, it's really not that crazy when like everybody I know has a story of being raped or punched by a guy or, you know, pulled into a car.
Yeah.
Or just like, you know, not getting a job because they're female or like whatever. Everybody I know, and then which is over half the population, and I'm singing songs about it, and people are freaking out. I'm like, this seems really not, I'm not Gwar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, I was like, Gwar is way scarier than we are.
Yeah.
You know, why aren't you freaked out about Gwar?
Because like, you threaten them.
Well, and that's part of the thing that's funny is like, guys, it's fine if anybody doesn't like our music. I'm always like, there's some of our music I don't even like. But it's like, it's fine if people are like, I just don't like the way that they put songs together. I don't like that kind of music. Yeah. I don't like the guitar sound. I don't like her voice. That's all fine. It's just when it's like, nobody talks about the songs. Nobody talks about the music. Nobody talks about my voice. Nobody talks about the guitar. Nobody talks about the drumming. All they say is, fuck them, they hate men.
Yeah.
And it's like, or they say they're not really musicians because they're activists, or they're not really. And it's like, I keep saying this, how many songs do I have to write before an article treats me like a real musician? Like, I've written real songs, like legitimate songs that like have beginnings, middles, and ends, and they're like on records.
Yeah, but there's a hypocrisy to it. From the get-go, it's like, you know, punk rock wasn't about, you know, necessarily being a perfect musician. It was about expressing a certain sentiment. And it was a free zone.
Yeah, right? It's about kids creating culture outside of corporations, right? And so I thought, and we thought, as a band, oh, well, guys go up all the time and just, like, play some stuff that they're just learning their instruments. And it's totally like, that's so cool, they're so punk. But when women or people of color or women of color do it, it's like, oh, they suck. They need to go home and work harder. You know, it's like, but if you show up and you're, you know, Stevie Ray Vaughan Jr. lady, then it's like, you're ridiculous. You know what I mean? Yeah, so it's like, you really can't win. So we were just like, well, this is what we want to do. We want to do punk rock, and that's what we're going to do. And if people are like, you don't know how to play, we're going to be like, yeah, it's punk rock.
But in reaction to this, you know, pushback or this reaction, that this is where the community really kind of becomes defined, right? That's where the idea of taking your counseling experience and creating spaces for women to talk about their issues, but also like that ultimately became somewhat of an exhausting liability on some level,
yes,
it seems. But that was the core of the beginning of the Riot Girl movement, was to create a space for women to have these ideas in public and to feel supported among themselves.
Well, it's kind of like what happens if you give a rape crisis counselor a guitar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, and also the ability to make flyers that say, come to my, you know, teenage sexual assault support group and hand them out from stage instead of like just put them up at the grocery store. Like a big thing, impetus for me of being in Bikini Kill was I was like, oh, I could look like some weird lady walking up to teenagers outside of the high school, right, inviting them to this group, or I could be the cool girl in a band talking about it from stage.
Yeah.
And maybe that would be a better fit. So it all kind of ran together, you know what I mean? And it was like, oh, I did counseling and I started to be like, I can't do intakes anymore because I'm burnt out on intakes. I can't do overnights anymore because they're terrifying. Overnights at the domestic violence shelter where nobody's supposed to know where it was, but you know, things happen.
Right.
You know, I can't do rape crisis phones anymore. I'm getting totally burnt out. Okay, I'll do public speaking.
Yeah.
So I started going to high schools and doing public speaking, and actually this band Unwound, all three of them at the time were in the class that I went to. Because they were high school students.
Yeah.
They weren't the band Unwound yet.
Yeah.
And it was really, it was pretty hilarious. They let me, like someone who was like, I was about 22, 23 years old, walk into a classroom and talk to people was like totally insane. In my mind, I was like, how'd they let me do this?
Yeah.
But I did it. And it was like, I think in a way that me like starting to go into high schools and give, you know, talks about sexual assault and consent and stuff like that, I was like, oh, I can't do the crisis phones anymore, but I can do this more performative thing where I'm in collaboration with an audience and I'm talking and, you know, and sometimes I would do full like auditoriums and I would have a mic. And it really, if you look at it, it's a natural evolution to like, and then I'm on stage singing.
Yeah.
Turning it into a poem song, which is what I like to call lyrics. But writing lyrics about the stuff that I was witnessing, and some of which I'd experienced and had friends experience. Because that's been the other thing that was very hard to contend with, is the idea that like everything I've written is autobiographical.
Right.
And it's not.
Yeah.
You know, it's like...
You're a songwriter.
I'm a songwriter. Yeah. I get ideas from all over the place. And now as I'm older, I do feel more like, oh, I could write like a narrative song if I wanted.
Sure.
I could, you know, go down a lot of different roads that I haven't gone down. But at the time, it felt very important to be specific and to be almost didactic and to be really clear, like, this is a feminist performance.
Yeah.
And it's not the only feminist performance, and it's from my perspective.
Right.
But it is a feminist performance. You're not seeing a mirage. This is really happening.
And it, and also the sort of evolution to doing that and trying to detach a bit from, you know, crisis counseling. Like there's points in the book where you said there were lines of girls who needed to talk, and that like your instinct is you wanted to do it, but you just couldn't, you didn't have the bandwidth. And then also then it seemed that you became the de facto leader of a situation that was becoming out of control. And there's a point in the book where you talk about the revelation of, you know, entitlement and racism within the feminist community that you were kind of attached to.
Yeah.
Because you had not, you know, what you were doing was in earnest and it was correct, but you were not seeing the full picture.
Yeah. And the punk scene that I was involved in was largely, it was at least run by white people.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't necessarily a welcoming space to people of color. And it was like, you know, the same way that I had felt unwelcomed at a lot of punk shows, I was a part of creating all white spaces or predominantly white spaces that didn't welcome BIPOC people.
Yeah.
And I had to contend with that. And I chronicled kind of my failures in the book, and also sort of, it's not like I'll ever come to terms with it. You know what I mean? Like, I've got to keep working on myself and reading books by other people. And that's the thing. So many amazing writers have written so many great books about their experiences or things that they know that I don't know about that I can read. I don't have to go up to somebody and be like, please explain to me as a white person how to be a better person, you know, how to be an ally. It's like, I feel like I've actually been really lucky that I've had so many men come up to me and be like, how can I be an ally? And I'm like, go read a book. You know what I mean? Like, Google feminism. You know what I mean? Like, that's not my job. And and I think going through some of those experiences, and obviously the template isn't the same for every situation.
Yeah.
But it really encouraged me to read a lot of books by people who see things different than me, who grew up different than me, who are different than me.
Yeah.
And that's really helped me to be like, oh, here's my limit. Here's my limitations.
So with Bikini Kill, I mean, like, what? In like, I know you guys are back at it, but like, what really was the point where you hit the wall the first time?
There's so many walls, but I mean, you know, honestly, I'm just going to tell you a weird story. I was really sick. I had a temperature of over 103, 104. Maybe.
When was this?
This was like probably, I think we broke up in 97 or 98. So it was like 97.
Yeah.
And I was in my apartment in Olympia, and I just had a mattress on the floor, and I was really extremely sick, and I was trying to do this thing for this political organization that I had started working with. They were doing a lot of stuff around freeing Mumia from jail, and I was trying to raise money and, like, do benefits and, like, all this stuff with this organization. And this woman called me and was like, I need you to try to reach out to Eddie Vedder and Zach De La Rocha.
Yeah.
Here's their number. They'd probably
take a call
from you and not from me. And I was like, I need to hold this off because I can't even get out of bed. Like, I had to crawl to the bathroom. I was so sick. And she's like, crawl to the fax machine and fucking fax them. And I was like, I never worked with that organization again. I hung up the phone. I did crawl to the thing and fax them.
Yeah.
And then I never did anything for them again, and I still won't. But I was like, okay, if someone is actively, like, saying the cause matters more than your health.
Yeah.
You got to get out of that. And it made me look at the rest of my life and be like, there were a few people in kind of the Riot Girl scene who were very like, you know, I'm the most anti-racist, anti-classist, anti-colonialist, and they were like white middle class people mostly, sure, having these like kind of like beauty pageant in reverse contests, you know, and it was like downwardly mobile, like bullshit and, you know, liberal guilt and all that kind of crap. Yeah. And it was like constantly attacking me. And I think part of it was just jealousy. It was like, because, you know, we were all fighting for the scraps off the man's table, and we're taught to think there's only so much. And so there could only be one cool punk feminist girl at a time. And I was that. So I was targeted by people in what I thought was my own community and from the mainstream outside telling me I was a slutty stripper man hater.
Yeah.
And it really just got to be too much. And I was like, I literally can't do this. And I'm getting physically ill.
Which turned out to be a real thing.
Yeah, which turned out I have an autoimmune illness, which we don't need to discuss because I hate talking about it. But I have an autoimmune illness. It is under control.
It took a while, though.
It took a long time.
It's a tough one.
It is a tough one. And most people don't believe in it. And so
what, Lyme's disease?
Yeah, it's definitely crazy if you're like, you have a PIC line in and you're like, you know, constantly in the emergency room and you like haven't been able to work for, you know, seven years. And people are like, it's not real. It's like, well, my body's telling me it is. It's like.
And also that was something I was trying to address earlier is that not unlike trolls, you know, in any community, you know, voices can be heard, but it doesn't mean they're going to be the voice. And I think there's a lot of resentment and jealousy and frustration on behalf of people that are not necessarily talented in a certain way to sort of figure out a way to get a stronghold in any community.
Yeah, and some people are just as talented.
Sure.
But like I said before, the way that it gets treated is, you know, oh, there can only be one woman band. There can only be one feminist. It used to be like there could only be one woman musician on a stage at a time. Like there'd be a bass player or, you know, and if there was like a female singer in one band, you wouldn't want to have another one because then they're compared to each other. It's like they wouldn't play and they still don't a lot of times on rock radio, if that even exists, won't play like a female singer next to another female singer. They'll play like one female singer every, you know, 10 records or if at all. And so it, you really get this thing in your head. So I don't really, I understand it. And I've been on the, I'm the jealous one side. So like, I totally get it. And also I am privileged, you know, I was like a skinny, cute white girl getting a lot of attention. And, you know, there were tons of bands that were great bands with women in it who weren't getting attention and had worked very hard. And then we were like, we don't want to do mainstream press. Fuck the mainstream press. Like, I can imagine to a lot of women who had worked really hard in the music industry proper to get where they were kind of like, oh, you think you're so great that you don't even need this and I'm fighting for it.
Right.
So, but we did, to me, I did that as a thing for my mental health.
Yeah. Like, well, there was also this thing that like doesn't exist anymore in the same way of this, the idea of selling out.
Oh yeah.
That was so huge. And that like it was, I think, I mean, I get it. And it certainly was enabled people to carve a different path for themselves and transcend in a different way. But a lot of that was bullshit.
Yeah. DIY till you die. Yeah. I mean, how the thing that is really frustrating about it is the only people who can afford to not have a day job and then do their own booking, their own press, their own everything. Like you have to, that's, it's a 40 hour, 50, 60, 70 hour a week job. If you're going to be in a band and do every single thing yourself, the only people who can afford to do that are people with trust funds or like, you know, rich parents or inheritance or whatever. Like we didn't have that and we were still trying to DIY everything. And it got to the point of like, sometimes I'm like, man, you know, if we would have just got a manager, like maybe we would have lasted a couple more years or put out another great album. Like, you know, but I honestly didn't know about a lot of those jobs. I mean, I did have a fax machine, which was, you know, pretty business, pretty business in the 90s. But, you know, I didn't know what a publicist did. I didn't know. I knew what a booking agent was. Right. I thought a manager just took a bunch of your money. Like, I had no idea that I didn't even realize I was doing all these jobs. You know, we did our own artwork. We did our own booking. We, you know, got the van. We, like, sometimes we had a roadie. Like, that was it. And doing that for 7 years on the level we were doing it was really a lot of work. And, you know, if we had rich parents, you know, maybe it would have been different. But that's why I think this sellout, having the sellout idea kind of dissolve and not be present is great because, you know, people need to make money off of their work and what they do, and or else the punk scene is going to be a bunch of rich white people.
All right. So after you hit the wall with that and you try to get your health back in place, it seemed like Joan Jett was the next key to the next evolution.
Yeah, because everybody needs a Joan Jett in their life.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, me and my, I mean, Joan called me on the phone.
Yeah.
My bandmates swear they didn't do it, but I know one of them did it. Someone wrote on a bikini. We had a Bikini Kill. All we had was a demo tape. And on the demo tape, someone wrote, "For a good time, call Kathleen," and put my phone number. And this person, who shall remain nameless, who refuses to say they did it, was at backstage at a Fugazi show in D.C. And Joan was there because she's a big Fugazi fan.
Yeah.
And this person handed Joan the cassette. And then I didn't know about any of this. I'm just like working my job, you know, with my life, you know, practicing with my band. And then I get a phone call and it's like, "Hi, it's Joan."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Joan who?" It's like, "Joan Jett." I'm like, like, "Who is this really?"
Yeah.
And it's like, "No, this is Joan Jett."
Yeah.
And we literally had a Glorious Days of Misspent Youth poster in the living room.
Yeah.
So I was looking at it while I was talking to her. And I was like, "This is like in the Jetsons, like a video phone call."
Like,
so 90s. And I really did not believe that it was her. And had no, she's like, "Did you put out this cassette? Are you the lead singer of this band?" And I started being like, "Wait, this actually might be her." And then I was just like, okay, what kind of hair do you have right now?
Yeah.
Because every Joan fan knows what kind of hair she has at that particular moment. Right. And I was like, and she goes, oh, it's like a bastardized, disheveled bob. And I was like, oh no, it's really Joan. Because that's what she had.
Yeah.
And yeah, she was just like, I want to come see you play. I love your band. And then she came and saw us and she's like, oh, that Rebel Girl song, that's the good one. I really like that one. I want to produce that. And I was, you know, she produced the Germs, the first Germs record.
Yeah, you know.
And you know, she's a legend in a million ways. She's in the Runaways, which, you know, prototype punk band, like just voice of an angel.
Yeah.
Heart of a demon, voice of an angel.
Yeah.
Joan Jett. But yeah, she was amazing. And she also really, again, provided family for me at a time when I felt really kind of like ousted from my own community. And like, I couldn't go to shows that were like feminist punk shows because I would just get nonstop hassled. Like people would be like, why did you do this? And this lyric and I was just like, oh God, like I created a fucking Frankenstein monster.
Well,
like,
it's interesting when trolls had to be in person.
No, there's a scene in the book where it's like, I had, what's the thing? Revenge porn done to me in person.
What?
This guy I dated took these pictures of me where I was like wearing a sexy negligee or
something. Was that the artist? Or the guy who did a show of the pictures?
Yeah. And he took these like pictures of me in this like see-through, you know, outfit. And I was like, no, don't. And he's like, just let me take a couple. And then he did. And he's like, I won't show it to anybody. And then after we broke up, he built a wooden cross and then nailed the pictures all over it in a public space, like in the library building right above where I worked. And I had to walk by it to rent stuff from the media loan where Kathy worked, the bass player for Bikini Kill, who I didn't know at the time. But I had to walk through there like every day and see those pictures. And I was like, this is and now that's what's so great about being 55 and writing the book is that I look back and I was like, oh, that was revenge porn before the internet.
You were
like,
at the beginning of it.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I feel like such a, you know, like.
But do you think Joan, in terms of where she eventually went with her career in creatively, was sort of the basis for La Tigra in a way?
I don't really relate that to her. I think of Joan as a singer.
Yeah.
Because what she can do vocally in a studio is magical. What she can do live with her voice is amazing.
But she eventually got a more defined pop sensibility in the later records.
Yeah. I mean, I think the main musical thing is that she taught me, hey, it's okay to have a job.
Yeah.
You know, like she got me jobs songwriting and singing backups on records. And I started being like, okay, I can earn a living at this.
Yeah.
After I quit Bikini Kill and sort of towards the end of that project. And then she taught me, I was doing this whole thing with my voice on the early records where like there was nothing on it. No reverb, no slapback. Like it was just completely raw. And there's a lot of early rap records where, you know, real close to the mic, there's like no reverb or anything on it. I wish I could say I was emulating that. I wasn't.
Yeah.
I was just sort of like, I don't want my voice to be airbrushed.
Yeah.
I don't want pantyhose on my voice.
Right.
Like, I want it to just be like in your face. That's great. But when I went in the studio with Joan and she was like putting reverb on me, putting slapback, she's like, Elvis, you slapback, let's try that. You know, like we were trying all these different things and experimenting. And also, I wasn't just singing the song three times and then picking the best take or picking the best verse. It was like
pieces.
Doing it, you know, like in film.
Yeah.
You know, where you like caught up.
And you didn't even know you could do that.
I knew, but like we didn't have the money to sit there and do that.
And did you think there was a lack of integrity to it?
No.
Oh, good.
No, it was just we literally did not have the money to sit there and piece stuff together. Sure. And we had the biggest budget, which I think it was like $2,000 or something for that single than we ever had
from
for
Kill
anything.
Rockstar?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had 2 days to do a single where usually we have like 5 days to do an album.
Yeah.
So it was like very luxuriant.
Right.
And yeah, I learned a lot from that because I was like, hey, my voice still sounds like me. It still sounds in your face. It still sounds exciting. The band still sounds exciting. And actually, the contrast of that sheen, of that little bit of pop sheen she put on us, made it feel like the band was like kind of fighting against the pop sheen, and it created this really interesting tension that you can get with, like, you can also get it if you have, like, a guitar that comes out too loud and starts blocking out the singer, and then the singer goes loud, and you're like, ah, they won, the singer won.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, you can create that tension, but I learned about creating that tension in the studio through her, and I learned, like, oh, I want to experiment more with how I produce myself, and I don't want to have these ideas of, like, don't put anything on your voice because that's sellout.
Well, how does that not lead to La Tigre?
That does. And so in that way, production-wise, it definitely did. Because I got really excited about production after that. And then I got, like, a 4-track and then an 8-track, and I started recording at home.
Drum machine.
Dramatics.
That was big.
For $40.
You still have it?
Yeah. Of course I do. Of course I do.
And by that point, you're with Adam, right?
Yeah.
And was how they were working any sort of influence?
The Beastie Boys? I mean, of course. Like, you know, I mean, mainly just being like, oh, whoa, they actually have fun in the studio. You know what I mean? And like, they set up their own studio. Like, all the different things that they did that I watched. And I was like, they have a publicist. And I was like, I want that. You know? And you know, my husband put out a lot of really, like, sexist, homophobic, crappy songs in the 80s and grew up and changed and became a different person, the person that I love. And in seeing that, that was really powerful and gave me the ability to see myself growing and changing. But it also was like, you know, even though they had an inflatable dick on stage and a dancer, Danielle, in a bikini, you know, like in a cage.
Yeah.
They never, besides when I got them to play a Mumia Abu Jamal protest, when they got protested, or a benefit show, they got protested by the police for that one. But they never really got protested. And I've been protested a million times, sometimes totally for the correct reasons. And I totally agreed with the protest. But for, like, weird things. And I was like, that's really wild. That's really wild that you had a dick, inflatable dick on stage and there was no protest about it. And yet I've, you know, been, like, threatened and
just for saying things.
And I was like, oh, okay. You know, some of this stuff, a lot of criticism against me, totally valid and totally helpful. But then a lot of it, it just isn't.
Fuck it.
Yeah. And so I was kind of like, okay, I just got to turn my bullshit detector up.
But I like that you were in love with the guy despite all that because it was something beyond his work.
Yeah. And he also wasn't doing that anymore. When I was on tour with them, it wasn't like the dick was there. It's in Long Island. It's still in Long Island.
In the Beastie Boy archive?
It's in a storage locker. And apparently the guys who work at the storage locker have a party once a year and it's hydraulic. It's not inflatable. That's the thing that's so hilarious is that when I'm like, the inflatable, because I can win any argument. You know, all I have to do is bring up the inflatable penis.
The hydraulic dick.
But then he goes, it's hydraulic. And I'm like, seriously, you're going to say that to me right now.
But so do you feel like with the La Tigre records that, like, you know, it puts you on the map in a different way? Because that was a big record deal. And it seems like it was ahead of its time in terms of, like, techno and some other stuff.
Yeah.
And then did you have your first real hit with them?
Not really. I mean, we were on an independent label, like, and currently we're on La Tigre Records that we own ourselves, and Bikini Kill's on Bikini Kill Records, which we own ourselves. But I mean, Decepticon became this, like, crazy out of control thing that just, like, everybody got into and played, and people know that song and it's wonderful. But it wasn't, like, a hit in terms of radio or any of that. I mean, we didn't even know the extent of it until years later because it keeps having a new life. Like, every few years it'll get revived and it'll get used in a bunch of movies. And that's how we get paid, is through sync licensing, because Spotify is, you know, fucked all of the musicians.
Yeah, yeah.
We could have, you know, 50 million plays and thanks for the $2.27. Really?
Even if it's on a playlist and you really, there's just no
You get less than a penny. You get, like, less than a penny for each. And, like, we used to, in the days of Apple Music, get a dollar a song. And we didn't get that whole dollar, but we got, like, 80 cents of it.
Right.
And, like, that was a lot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm waxing fondly about 1998.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, that it really was a departure for me. And the really exciting thing for me was that a lot of people, it wasn't like the Bikini Kill girl is in Lake Tigre. Like, people thought I was a totally different person.
We had a different name, right?
No, I still use the name Kathleen Hanna, but I did a solo record in between called Julie Ruin.
Yeah.
Which was like, you know, my Sasha Fierce or my Chris Gaines.
Yeah, yeah.
I was really just following Chris Gaines.
Yeah. Was that Garth Brooks?
Yeah. His eyeliner, like Kurt Cobain face.
That was so wild.
It was really wild. That, I think, happened after Julie Ruin, and I was like, oh my God, I'm like Chris Gaines. I just didn't want my name on the record. It was weird. But I did put my face on it. But I made this record that was like electronic, and then it ended up being Lake Tigre, and, you know, we did a lot of stuff, and we did sign to a major label for like one record, and didn't go great.
Yeah.
Didn't love it. And
Where they put the promotional money into something else. And
Into JoJo.
Yeah.
Who I think she had a hit with a song called like Get Back or Stand Back, Boy. I mean, no disrespect towards her.
Sure.
Like,
but now you're touring with Bikini.
Yes.
Original lineup?
Original lineup, except Bill, who does not want to tour. So Sarah Lando, who is a very good friend of mine and was in the Julie Ruin band experience with Kathy and I. It's our guitar player, and she's amazing. Like, just listening to her guitar playing through the monitor while I'm singing, and like, it sounds like there's two people playing at the same time.
Really?
Yeah.
But like, so after all this, the book and Lyme's disease and going through.
The tornado that took my house away.
All of it. The cars, the apartments. And then, you know, finally, you know, having, you know, a child and you know, the adoption process and all that. Do you find now when you look back at everything, or at least do you get back that you did actually change things? I mean, do you feel like, do you have enough women who come up to you who are in their 40s now and say, like, you know, it made all the difference to me? Do you feel like, if not the music, being of service in the way you were is validating?
Yeah, it's totally validating. And I can take it in to a certain extent, but you know what I mean? It's like if you really, I can't rely on external validation, even though I love it.
Wait, you can't? God damn it.
Mark, your therapist is talking to me through my other ear.
I know you can't, but boy, you know, and I resist it, which I think is something you do too, because of the nature of who we are as people and the way we own ourselves. It's like, if something comes at me that's positive, I mean, I'm like 30 seconds away from being like, all right, where's the negative stuff?
Okay, do you look out in the audience and see the one person who's laughing? Okay, I'm the same way. I look out and I see the one person who's not reacting, and I'm like, I will make that person dance.
Yes, yes.
I will make that person dance. And then I had to get over it this tour, because I was like, there are certain places where people in the front just don't dance, or they're too squished, or they're too, like, whatever.
Sure.
Or there's someone whose, like, partner brought them, and they don't like the music, and it's like,
that's
fine.
Yeah.
And I was like, I really had to make an effort to focus on the people who are having a great time.
Oh, so
and
funny.
I would pick a couple people and just watch them dance and be so psyched. I would like dance with them. And it's really, you should try it. Try looking at the people who are laughing and perform for them. Don't perform for someone who is like doing their laundry in their head.
Why do our eyes always fall on them though? I mean, it happens all the time where like it'll get to a point where I'm doing stand-up. It happened the other night where I'll see the one person.
Who leaves?
I know,
the person who leaves, and then you start
well, there's a bit of that. Like, are you all right? Where are you going?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But they're just going to the bathroom. But if I see somebody who's not laughing, sometimes they'll be like, are you having a good time? Is it okay? Is this landing? And then they freak out. But a lot of times it is that. They don't know me. They're brought to the show. They're thinking about something else, or maybe they're receiving it differently. You know, a lot of times people don't react the way you want them to react, and they're still taking
Or maybe they're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm in the same room with my fucking idol. I love this guy so much.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do. Like, you have no idea. They could be stunned. They've never seen like a professional comedian before. Like, you have no idea what it is. They could have gotten a horrible diagnosis.
Sure,
they could
have
like IBS, and they're like, oh God, where's the bathroom?
I hope I get through
like,
this, yeah.
Yeah. So you got to just like let that go and detach. But I mean, I can tell you that it doesn't matter why. It matters what you do with it now.
Sure.
I know you have a thing in your brain that's like, you got this, Mark.
Yeah.
Like, you just got to go back to, you got this, Mark.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, it's fine.
But the thing I was saying about praise and stuff is that, like, yes, I feel like I have shaped culture in a certain way in the indie punk feminist world and maybe beyond. I mean, I do see girl power shirts at Target very often.
Is that a positive thing?
It's a whatever thing. You know what I mean? Like, I don't really think about it too much. But it's also like, I don't believe in the like, all press is good press. I don't believe in a lot of the old showbizisms. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like, drink yourself to death. Yeah. I just don't believe in a lot of it. One of the things is that while I really appreciate people saying, and it can be really nice and lovely to hear, like, you helped me through a bad time.
Right.
It has been like something that's kept me going and I can take it in. I don't dwell on it because if I dwell on it, I have to dwell on all the negative stuff too. And my thing is like, I really care what my best friend thinks. I really care what my mom thinks.
Right.
I care, you know, what the people in my actual life think of me and how I'm doing as a friend and a mom.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the real thing. And so I just feel like I'm at the place now where I'm doing it for enjoyment, not for external validation.
That's good.
So it's like I let kind of the negative and the positive roll off me a little because also you don't want to become like some egomaniac who's like, I changed culture, God damn it.
I don't feel that. But I do I do like that because for me it was like a byproduct of doing this podcast or whatever kind of comedy I do that where I do get a significant amount of people who are like, you know, you got me through a dark time. And that's like – that is actually the most rewarding thing.
Yeah.
That. Just that one. Or if I help somebody get sober. Like those things have – in terms of facilitating any sort of change, just the idea, and I think it's part of what the initial Riot Girl thing was about, was to make people who were alone with their fucking problems and had no outside, you know, way to compare or think that other people are going through it, to realize that they're not, that's the best you can do.
Yeah. If you can help somebody like get to the place where they're doing the thing they really want to do.
Yeah.
Or not destroying themselves, then... Yeah. These are the validating things, and that's where it gets back to our conversation of what feels really important is like validating other people who are like doing cool, creative, progressive things.
Especially if they're people you respect and
Then being validated by, you know, having cool media out there, actually seeing something that reflects you or reflects your friends.
Yeah,
you know?
It's nice.
Great. This has been an awesome talk. I feel like we really made up from the time I didn't recognize you.
Yeah.
And I said I was a comedy head, and yet I blanked you.
I was good with it before we got started. I'm glad it all worked out. It's good talking to you.
But you wouldn't have recognized me either.
No. I don't know if that made me.
Well, you recognized me because I was at my house.
That's
like cheating. You like cheated on a test.
No, I'd done some work. I'd listened. You know, I'd done, you know, I knew who you were. I was intimidated. You know,
what?
Of course.
I'm like so nice.
No, but you're going to tell me you've never been intimidating?
What?
You've never been intimidating?
Intimidating?
Yeah.
Well, like, I don't know.
Exactly. It was all me. Half of it was me.
See, that's the thing. It's projection because, like, a lot of people tell me I'm intimidating and, like, I'm actually totally not. And it's so annoying because it's like, that's your thing. That's your problem.
Well, yeah, but the people that know you're not. But people who don't know you, for whatever reason, I get it all the time. And I'm like, I'm not even thinking about you right now.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not even thinking about you right now.
Yeah.
Okay. You know what's been really positive about this conversation, Mark?
What?
Is that I've seen that it's not that like sometimes it's hard to pull apart the like I'm a political musician part from the like I'm just a person making work part.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing that like you get some of the same stuff.
Yeah.
The way it comes to me is a little bit more dramatic.
Yeah.
Probably.
Right.
You know, But it's not just like a sexism thing.
No.
You know, and like that's actually one of the horrible damaging things about like all of the, you know, oppression in the world is that people are constantly having to be like, is this a thing because of
this?
You know, because I'm not a straight white male or is it because of this? And it's like, and sometimes missing the mark on thinking it's this, but it's not. And it's like, you know what? It's fine to miss the mark and think it is. Everything in your world has told you that this is probably sexism because it typically is.
Sure.
But it's like the intimidating thing with being a feminist artist is like it's also coupled with you're a man hater. So men typically will be intimidated by me when they've never met me.
Right.
And I'm like, I'm not saying that about you. I'm just saying that, like, it's like, she's a ball buster.
Right, right. Yeah,
you
know,
we did Leigh Tigger did a TV show in England once, and the guy who introduced us was like, and now for the ball busting, man tearing up group Leigh Tigger. And then we came on, and, like, I'm wearing a pink dress, and I'm like, Hot Topic is the way that we rhyme. And it was like,
The people just want, they want to create juice.
Yeah.
Bad stuff. Yeah, we're all right.
But this has been wonderful.
It has been great. I'm so glad we did it. I have a present for you, too.
Oh, no.
No, I found,
I love you, Kathleen.
No. No, I have a lot of stuff, you know, as you get older. I'm sure you
is
do,
is it that
too.
Guitar? It better be. I'm just kidding. Let's go, because I got it. Can I touch it?
Yeah, okay.
Oh, my God, you have to take that off.
No, we know you're talking about the guitar.
Okay.
There you go. Her book is called Rebel Girl, My Life as a Feminist Punk. Get it where you get the books. Hang out for a minute, folks. So look, people, more outtakes are now posted for Full Marin listeners. We've got a new batch of clips that didn't make it into recent episodes, including stuff with Moon Zappa, Michael Rooker, and Greg Fitzsimmons.
Well, Lenny is the guy that...
Lenny.
You can't argue it. Like, he, of course, did questionable material, but I don't know anybody that had the charisma, has the charisma of Lenny Clark.
Oh, my God.
And off stage.
What was that story? Do you know that story? I tried to tell it, the one about, I don't know if it was Billy Martin or Bobcat, now that I think about it. The story about how, the way I used to tell it was that Lenny Clark, like, Bobcat had gotten Letterman.
Yeah.
You know, and he was like, what, 22 or 23?
Uh-huh.
And he had moved down to Boston from upstate New York with Tom Kenny, and he got Letterman. And the story is that Lenny went up to him at a club, pulled, you know, picked him up by the shirt collar, slammed him against the wall, and said, "It's not your turn." And it's like, yep, that tracks.
That's hilarious.
To get bonus episodes twice a week, sign up for the Full Marin. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast, and this is me playing with my looper. I'm not good at the endings. I got to figure out how to fade or something, but I laid down a track that actually had, let's see, 1, 2, 3 guitar tracks, and then I played on top of that. And look, I don't know what I'm doing, so don't, you know, it's not tight. It's not pro. It's not pro.
Boomer Lives, Monkey and LaFonda, Cat Angels Everywhere. I got to figure out how to fade out. I got to figure out how to fade out.